Episode 7. Welcome back. Or you're very welcome if this is your first time here. There's been major advancements since we last spoke, just a week ago. I Spray My Mental Health podcast has climbed above the blundering ditch of roughness from whence it came, and now sits organised at the very nerve centre of my existence. So yeah, basically in English, I set up a desk in the spare room in the house, and it has that feel like a new beginning. Like September, going back to school, new year, it's a new me, I'm focused, I'm ready. This is exam year, I'm going to rock this mother. And then boom, week and a half later, the desk is a fucking clothes horse, never to be used again. So I'm sat in the family room, as it is, or as it was. Long sitting room. If you stood out in the garden, you'd see right through to the back. It's a room that would divide opinion. You'd either walk in here and immediately scream, this place needs to be fucking torched. Or otherwise walk in and say, yeah, you know, this digs has got character. And I'm of the latter. There's quiet vibrance to this place. It should remain untouched. I'm looking around. There's fine mahogany, one of those big cabinets that you're wondering how the fuck did they actually get that in the door. Full of brandy glasses, probably never be used. There's, oh, the carpet just screams 1972. There's framed pictures of every distant cousin you're never ever going to meet. And one sole printout that a Polaroid of probably the youngest child probably came in a Christmas card and there was no frame to back it up. And for 20 odd years, that poor bastard has just been leaning against the frame of another child. You've got the token rocking chair up in the corner. If that thing ever moves in the middle of the night, I am out of here. And of course, you've a framed picture of the Pope. Visit Phoenix Park, 1979. A time when people cared. And then the piece of resistance. A fucking framed signed picture of Irish actor extraordinaire Aidan Quinn. It's the most fucking random inclusion to a family room. And amongst all them portraits and all this meaning, all this vibrance, Aidan Quinn. Like, he looks fresh, looks handsome, most likely taken some time ago. So I've taken Aidan, and he's now placed on the desk in front of me, irrepressive, rugged good looks, song for a raggy boy, Aidan Quinn, the oracle of I Sprain My Mental Health podcast. That's fucking mental. I need to find out the backstory to this, how this came to be. So I also made a purchase, a microphone bought from a warehouse website named after a long river. There'll be no free shout outs on this podcast. It's not quite 1950s American diner megaphone material, but it's subtle. Just a wire, clip it into the phone, and a small microphone just clips onto your collar. And it's more special correspondence reporting outside the White House. Latest news from the White House. The guy who lives here is a prick. So, previously, it may have sounded as if I was shouting at you from the end of your street. But this new addition, it should help with the audio consistency and give a more intimate experience. Like I'm now shouting at you through your letterbox. So I Spray My Mental Health, episode 7. We'll rock on. There was a very solid response to the discussion on last week's episode. Now, I make that sound as if this is a finely tuned operation topping the charts every week. I Spray My Mental Health podcast is not. But I toured the listeners last week. 8 or 9 people sent in replies to this discussion. And statistical analysis will tell you that that's nearly 30% of listeners are engaging. So we'll work on that. So there's a positive. But I asked a question on whether in writing, blogging, highlighting matters around mental health, are we going about it the right way, with the right intentions and the right expectations? And it was quite an elaborative contribution from listeners, as I said. And I approach this topic with the slightest of trepidation. And the reason being, I didn't want to appropriate an absolute opinion on such a sensitive matter. And I was also conscious that there may well have been somebody listening that does blog or talk openly about their own mental health. And I didn't want this person second-guessing themselves or feeling undermined. And I was conscious that the diluted message could have been a bit more sinister. And people may be thinking, Jesus, Dave O'Connor's telling people not to talk about his mental health. He's saying it's a load of bollocks. And that wasn't the case. The message was really, really clear last week. If you haven't listened to the episode, please go back and do so. And you can share your opinion afterwards, which would be greatly appreciated. Join the conversation. But the message was simple for me. I was making the point just to protect yourself. If you've made a decision that you're comfortable in sharing detail about your own mental health experiences, don't place yourself on a digital pedestal that could result in you being overridden by pressure and your initial intentions are lost and suddenly you feel worse about yourself. We all want to inspire other people, but we've got to look after ourselves first. If we can't look after ourselves, we can't look after other people. Am I qualified to give this advice, to give these shout-outs? I don't know, but I can only speak of my own experiences. And I gave an example last week of how I lost myself in this glorified pride, making those comparisons to other people, making these judgments that my work was better than others, just being a prick basically. And the essence of my therapeutic practice, that is writing, was lost. And the reason I started writing about my mental health was lost. Really simple. And I ended up stopping as a result. And as I said, I'm not going to start hammering other people without giving an example of myself. And I had a couple of other issues that were probably a little bit more outside of my control, sort of external interferences, when I was sharing work. I had a really strange one a couple of years ago. And if anybody's listening, this is not anyone listening or anybody I know. This was a stranger I'd never come across. I didn't follow them online or anything. I just had somebody sort of observing from a distance. And this is a real example of that blinding rise of selfdom that somebody can sort of experience with social media. So in sharing that blog and writing about, whether it was poems or video, spoken word, just different articles about my own experiences, I had one individual rate and review anything I shared online the same way a school teacher would to a child's homework. It was like a pat on the fucking back. It was such a strange experience. And any interaction that followed was just this condescending diatribe with meaningless pleasantries. And it ultimately made me very paranoid for a start, but I felt very inadequate. And I didn't really know how to deal with it because I didn't really want to extend in the conversation with this person. Community online, connecting with people online should be a vibrant experience and fulfilling. And I didn't want to go down this line. I found it so discouraging. And it intimidated me a bit. And this is probably one example of that downside of social media and where we are in current lines of society. Like, that's a hierarchy for me. Like, that's somebody who maybe feels they're competing with others, that they're pushing to elevate their imaginary status in this online hierarchy. Now, I'm getting fucking deep here talking about hierarchies and social media, but I do believe it exists. And they're almost looking to defend this place that they hold above others, pushing others back. Like, that's a fucked up digital survival tool right there. Like, that's warped primal metamorphosis. That is just, that's fucked up. And it's a downside, as I said. So when you get somebody maybe measuring their happiness and what their status is online, it's not a good place to be. And it kind of cracks back into what I was saying just about protecting yourself. Don't find yourself as far down that line as I was, where shit like this would bother you. Just protect yourself. So this conversation, Jesus Christ, how the fuck did I get onto that? Fucking hierarchies. It is relevant. It's relevant in the real world as well as social media. The hierarchical approach, person focuses outward, looks at somebody and immediately thinks, what can this person do for me? Now, fuck that shit. You want something done, there's only one place to look, my friend. Look inwards. There you go. That's the modern world. To move on slightly, or to move back, before blinding rants about the crushing footsteps of ego and vanity, this conversation came to me at the realisation that, for better or for worse, mental health is a fucking trend online. And I did a little bit of research on it, and this was before World Mental Health Day, so the figures have probably changed somewhat, but I had a look at a couple of hashtags just on Instagram, just to see how many posts came back. It was phenomenal. Hashtag mental health awareness, 2.6 million posts. Hashtag anxiety, 9.3 million. Hashtag depression, 16.2 million posts online on Instagram alone about depression. Now that could be a mixed bag. You could be looking at motivational quotes, somebody sharing someone else's story that has already been posted, personal experiences, personal observations. It's quite a mixed bag, but that is remarkable. And when I did this last week, I made a comparison to what was very relevant in current affairs. So last week, hashtag Ronaldo, 7 million. Hashtag Ryder Cup, 153,000. Hashtag Donald Trump, 4.9 million. So these three topics of discussion, that, as I said, were quite, like, were pretty much headline news on any local or national radio station, TV station, online platforms. They pale into insignificance of the amount of content being shared in relation to depression. 16.2 million. Like, that is unbelievable. Just a point as well, that is the second time I've made a reference to Donald Trump in this episode, and that will be the final time. I'd be wasting valuable airspace with that. But back on the serious note, was really blown away by this. And on the conversation, just to highlight a couple of the replies that came in, it's not all dreadful. And for me, there's definitely goodness, there's commonality, there is connection, there's friendship to be made when you can connect with somebody who has gone through something that they understand, that's something you understand, that there's a common bond there. That's not just mental health. I mean, it's relative to sports, to politics, to anything, whatever your niche is online. But some of the more positive contributions that came in, social media is at its best when people are honest and share for a common purpose. Sharing mental health stories online does make it more open and commonplace, but the problem therein exists with people translating that to the real world. Great point. And I think it's maybe a safe place for somebody to talk to a stranger online. It's a convenient space in a way that your device, your phone, your handheld is there in front of you. And there's convenience in it as well. And how do you translate that into the real world? I don't really know the answer to that. It's a difficult one. If you have to make that physical step to go to a counsellor, to go to a meeting group, it's a big, big ask than leaving the safety of what could be your own bedroom, where you may be sharing just a snippet, something you're comfortable with. I don't know the answer to that, but it's a good point. And it's probably, when you say common purpose, that's what I mean when I talk about commonality. This person has highlighted that. Similar was another message that came in. If clicking on mental health related hashtags, like the ones I've just highlighted, helps somebody realise that there are others out there that are experiencing similar issues, it may help them make the positive action step for themselves. Maybe that's how you get people to translate it to the real world. It's just so complex, it's so difficult. And to articulate this in my own mind on an idle Wednesday afternoon, it's difficult. I really don't know the answer, and there's no point in me pretending that I do. Are there people who have read other stories and made a decision for themselves to do something about their mental health? I have absolutely no doubt that there is. Are there people that read these hashtags and these stories and feel worse about themselves? Equally, I think there are those people. It's such a rabbit hole of confusion, of delight, of hope, of misery, it's just a concoction of emotions that I don't think one person will have the answer to this. And this is maybe the issue when we talk about budgets and we talk about money being pumped in and where the country can go in terms of bettering the services provided for mental health. Some things just cannot be helped. So it's just such a difficult sphere to grasp. It really is. And this is where I get muddled now. I start thinking so much about it, I can't even think straight. One more comment here just to come in. When I started sharing my story online, I immediately began connecting with others. Those people are now my friends. I never would have met these people without social media. It's empowering. Hope is visual on social media, and that's a good thing. I love that. Hope is visual. And yeah, I'm going to rob that. No shame there. I will be robbing that. Hope is visual. We spark large on different learning points, don't we? Some people learn really well in terms of audio. Some people learn really well with visual. Some people will just learn only with practical. And if the visual element of Instagram or social media is something that does give people hope, and I think an example of that is maybe just a lot of the graphics you see with inspirational quotes and that, brilliant. Happy days, if that works for somebody, fucking wonderful. Hope is visual. I'm going to highlight that because it will be popping up again soon. Pleasure isn't at its finest. So again, just connection, community, it is important. And I bring this up every week. It's the finest point of relevance of hope I have in my life was the 10 marathons in 10 days. I'll be probably referencing this for the next 50 years. Did I ever tell you I did 10 marathons in 10? Yeah, Dave, you told us 40 years ago. Yeah, okay, fair enough. But to highlight what a wear 10 and 10 achieved, like, it was more than me just running a couple of laps of a feckin' running track for 10 days. And I liken it to Kevin Costner, Field of Dreams. If you build it, they will come. And I'm very lucky. I had an incredible team around me working on this. And I just think the environment that we built in the lead up to that challenge and right during the 10 days, it gave something that absolutely anyone and everyone could have been a part of. And for me, it wasn't just family or friends. It was everybody. There were people I've never met before, people who I just connected with on social media, that came up, introduced themselves, ran with me, gave a donation, and kept in touch with me afterwards. That's the positive. I got really deep about hierarchies, given a little bit of negatives about social media. That's a fucking positive right there. The people I met, people got me through that challenge, and I keep saying that. I always relay this sentence, just true altruism and human decency. People believing in the cause and what it was being done for, people understanding what it was done for, and people wanting to be a part of it. And without social media, we never would have made that impact. In sporting circles, it blew up all around throughout the world of football. That's my network. We use the network really well. But again, within the confines of that network, everybody from players to coaches to clubs, board members, everybody bought into it because it made sense. And that was from content being shared and being delivered online. And it was remarkable. I genuinely don't think I'll ever experience anything as beautiful in my life. It was such a poignant experience. It really was. And that's just to back up those 3 points about commonality, connection, friendship and community, and how I experienced that in matching social media, online environments, with the real world, and it came together. And I think that backs up those 3 messages that came in there just about the conversation that we started last week. I lacked a buoyant flow in that previous section. I finished on quite a depressing note, really. I think I uttered something along the lines of, some things cannot be fixed. And that's a fucking defeat right there. Like, the intrinsic purpose with this podcast is that the creativity and the ideas that come with it, that create some warmth in sharing my principles and my mental health. And not just for me, for someone listening, I obviously want to garner some hope for people. But I just lacked that phrenic efficiency in addressing those replies that people shared with me. And I just found myself a bit uncertain, just in examining what can be done to improve the situation and offering some kind of answer. And I considered deleting the segment and starting again. But I figured, no, I said, fuck that, actually. I said, listen, some things cannot be fixed. Like, that is how I feel sometimes when it comes to my own struggles. And that is how I feel sometimes when it comes to mental health support and service in this country, when you're waiting around for announcements and commitments to turn into action. So I said, no, leave it. I was tired recording that last segment. It was late in the day. And at another time, I maybe might have come out with something a bit more productive. But look, that's the essence of this podcast. I'm just saying what I feel at that moment. So I left it in. I didn't delete it. If it was disappointing for you, that's just the true nature of where I was at that very moment. And I'm going to back it up now with something a bit more positive. And it was a blip in my resolve, a lack of emotional energy, and only a blotch on a thesis of personal development. And I refuse to let that be defined by a lack of resources from people making promises. And I think that dour note has probably given me a bit of clarity on this entire discussion in bettering yourself to better others. And I think that's maybe given me the important angle if we're talking about mental health, and not to get sucked in too heavily on giving detailed advice on what to do. Like, here's what to do. The fucking best advice: link up places that are professionally set up to help people who find themselves in a depressing state or otherwise. Aware, PA the House, Jigsaw. That's what they're there for. To set up, to provide a service for people who are find themselves in a difficult time of their life. There are options. And like, there's your crescendo of mental health awareness. Talk about your experience, but trump those services either privately or publicly. Make them fucking seen. And fuck the hashtags. I said that last week. Fuck everything. Like, fuck waiting around for stuff to happen. Just make it happen yourself, because look, you're too good to be fucking miserable, too good to be lost, too good to be depressed. One small step to betterment within. You're fucking capable. Some things just can't be fixed. Fuck that shit. Everything can be fixed. Fucking everything can be fixed. Fucking mind yourselves. So halfway through, time to move on to much lighter content. I do this every week. A toast to creativity. In previous episodes, I've looked at a range of craziness that people get up to, and interesting things and inspiring things that people do. So last week I looked at the work of Michael Tucker. He runs a wonderful YouTube channel called Lessons from the Screenplay, where he just dissects the makeup of screenplay and filmmaking. And I looked at one of his videos in which he examines the development of character through the theme, T-H-E-M-E, of the film Jurassic Park. And I think I owe people an apology of my generation. Apparently I've ruined a childhood favourite for a lot of people. This is a film about dinosaurs and imagination. And I've put this really detailed, thought-provoking meaning behind everything that stands in the film. And I don't apologise, that's art. So at one person, a good friend of mine, he went back and watched it and just said it was, he looked at it in a completely different light. And yeah, he's the person that told me I ruined it for him. But excellent work, Michael Tucker, Lessons from the Screenplay. Go and check out his work, it's fantastic. So this week I'm looking at a book I just finished reading, The War of Art by American author Stephen Pressfield. And love this book. Beautiful bend to it, nice fit. It's compact, you can bring it with you. It's not like a fucking hardback encyclopedia. It's like carrying a four-posted queen-size bed onto the bus with you in the morning. But anywho, Pressfield, he's ex-Marine Corps, kind of famous for just kind of struggle he went through in making a living as an author. And he states in a lot of his interviews and that about he had a period of his life where he had to live in the back of his car. He's had a good mix of books out, fiction and non-fiction. Some of his work have been developed into movies. His first book, Legend of Bagger Vance, absolutely wonderful name. It's about, I suppose it's relative to mental health, kind of a spiritual journey that the main character solved his issues by learning to play golf. It stars Will Smith and Matt Damon. I've never seen it. I guarantee you, Will Smith is the good guy in that. There is no way he plays the antagonist. Absolutely no way. Although he's kind of an anti-hero in Hancock. Hancock wasn't bad. He plays a similar role in that fucking abomination of a DC movie. Oh, shite. Suicide Squad. Oh, my God. Suicide Squad. That had to be one of the greatest disappointments in my life when it comes to film. Suicide Squad. If a group of transition year students were tasked with the project of producing a film and they handed in Suicide Squad as their final work, I'm pretty sure they'd fail and the teacher would not allow them to carry on to fifth and sixth year because they clearly would not be ready creatively to complete their leaving cert. Oh, it was tragic. How, like, the greatest way I can describe Suicide Squad. Don't worry, this podcast has no structure whatsoever. No plan. And just has a lot of music playing in the background. Yeah, that's pretty much Suicide Squad. Only with a lot more money behind it and really famous actors thrown into. It was such a bad movie. Anyway, The Legend of Bagger Vance. Go and check it out. Will Smith plays the good guy. So he's a couple of other books anyway. Stephen Pressfield, went off topic there, tend to do that. He has a book called The Gates of Fire. It's about the Spartans, Battle of Thermopylae, Battle of the Thermostat. And that Thermopylae is obviously the famous story about 300 Spartans standing up to the Persians, the film 300. And Thermopylae stands for the Hot Gates. So Pressfield works, he actually does a lot of work as a historian with National Geographic on this actual topic. It's quite a specialised topic for him. I'm going to check that book out actually, because that's a really interesting subject matter. And on the other side, that's all fiction work. On non-fiction, he does work, he's kind of galvanising journals just to put good practice in place with your art and your creativity. And he has a book called Do the Work, The Warrior Ethos and Turning Pro. And The War of Art, which I read, it's about, its description is break through the blocks and win your inner creative battles. And it's a focus on what he calls resistance. So resistance is the excuse. Resistance is, it's procrastinating. And he breaks this book into three parts. And Jesus, what is that on in the background? That's not my usual background soothing melody. We leave it on anyway. So he breaks his book into three parts. And book one, resistance, defining the enemy. And what he basically does here, he calls out a list of the most commonly elicited resistance or excuses that we come up with. And through different things that we can all recognise. So he actually lists it, like starting your own business, you look for an excuse. New diet, you look for an excuse. Exercise, training plan, you look for an excuse. Further education, better decisions you want to make for your life, whether through relationship, parenthood, different areas of commitment, we'll find excuses. And this section, I'm just focusing on this for now, book one, resistance. It's 60 pages. 60 pages of excuses, and I was looking at this and saying, hang on a sec, you're milking it here. But I thought about it some more and I said, hang on a second, think of something you want to do. Could I, if I really wanted to, list 60 excuses? And I think I could. I think all of us could, and I think that's the point he's trying to make. So why do I believe that? Well, simple, because procrastinating, it's a warped stress relief. Which ultimately leads to further stress. And I'm that type of guy, if the deadline is Wednesday midnight, I'll have it on your desk at 11:59. And Yeah, so I could probably make a list of 60 reasons not to do something, but I'd probably procrastinate and come up with another 60 reasons for not doing that list, and so on and so forth. So defining the enemy, book one, to give some examples of what Pressfield has written. He says, resistance is invisible, cannot be seen, touched, heard or smelled, but it can be felt. We experience it as an energy field radiating from a working potential. It's repelling force. It's negative. Its aim is to shove us away, distract us, prevent us from doing work. Everyone can relate to it. We all fall back in that kind of chosen operational paralysis, backed up with sorry justifications, whether it's Netflix, flick through my phone, have to go out, have to do this. Everybody, we all experience it, and if you don't, you're a bloody liar. And this is one of my favourite ones. Resistance and criticism. If you find yourself criticising other people, you're probably doing it out of your own resistance. When we see others beginning to live their authentic selves, it drives us crazy if we have not lived out our own. Individuals who are realised in their own lives almost never criticise others. If they speak at all, it's to offer encouragement. So watch yourself. Of all the manifestations of resistance, most only harm ourselves. Criticism and cruelty harm others as well. I love that. He had me at this. This was early in the book, and he had me at that. And it just got me thinking of just the environments I've found myself in over the years. And I think we've all found ourselves in a job or a club or a situation that's just noxious, just fueled with negativity. And I read, it was Jerry Hussey, he's a sports psychologist, performance coach. He gave a talk one day and he gave this great example. He said, if you stand over a frying pan cooking sausages all day, then walk into another room, what's the first thing people will notice about you? Obviously, you're going to smell of sausages. And if you spend the entire day, whether it's work or your club, whatever, as I said, mixed in a room with negative people and you walk out, the first thing people are going to know about you is that you'll have that negativity immersed inside you, and the first thing you're probably going to say is something negative about the people you've just been dealing with. And there's a really big difference between this kind of colloquial interaction on an everyday basis, where you're talking about weather or football, did you see the match last night, like that's just generic and it's fine. But when you go down that road of these kind of focused adverse reviews on other people, regardless of the reasons of what they've said or done, it says more about the sayer than the doer. And I made this kind of conscious approach early this year. I've just been quite attentive in my approach in conference with other people, in discussions with other people, is that I was just going to consciously, if I felt this kind of rise where I was about to start having a pop at somebody, whether it was something extreme or something quite ridiculously petty, it didn't really matter. When that urge came, it was to scale it back and say, no, unless my judgment can better the situation, I'll say nothing. And like, it works. It 100% works. And I'm not going to behave like I'm a feckin' monk sitting on the top of a rooftop cabin on the side of some mountain in Tibet and I've figured everything out in life, because I fucking haven't. But it definitely made me more aware of what I'm saying. It does slip, and probably more in football terms is when I lose it a little bit and you're maybe having a go at this fella for not doing that. You have to have some release. But in kind of my everyday life and interaction with people, I've become quite conscious with it. Give it a go. Have a listen to your own conversations that you're either having with people or having with yourself. If you feel that urge to have a pop at somebody, like, just reel it in. Is this going to make a difference? Is it going to better the situation? Most likely, it's fucking not. No one's perfect, but give it a go. So 60 pages of excuses. Here's where your life isn't where it should be. And it's not a folder of negativity. If you're kind of thinking, why in the name of Jesus would I want to read 60 pages on procrastinating? Which effectively could fall under the category of more procrastinating. Instead of reading the 60 pages, I could probably go and do something.
But to be fair to the author, he professes right from the start, with integrity, that, like, look, the enemy, resistance, there's a scale of opportunity to understand better why we resist, why we make excuses. And this field of resistance is a learning tool. And there's some lovely segments in this book. I'm still on book one. I wanted to look at this book in its entirety today, but I'm conscious that if I keep going, this is going to be a fucking Joe Rogan 3-hour special. And I don't want that. I don't want to be taking up too much time of your life, which I've done already, nearly 45 minutes. So what I'll do, I'll stick with book one. I'll finish up on book one for now. I look at book two next week. He talks about turning pro and just really buying into what you want to achieve. Now, he speaks conditionally about sort of writing and art, but look, you can put this into, there's elemental truth in what he talks about and what he writes about that you can place into different areas of your life. And I look at that next week, because that's going to be an interesting one. I can tie in a lot of sport-related material as well with that. But for this one, nearing the end of book one, he's this lovely little paragraph on resistance and love. Resistance is directly proportional to love. If you're feeling massive resistance, the good news is it means there's tremendous love there too. If you didn't love the project that is terrifying you, you wouldn't feel anything. The opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. The more resistance you experience, the more important your unmanifested art project enterprise is to you, and the more gratification you will feel when you finally do it. And that's, I suppose that's an expansion on that sentence. I'd hear it a lot. I've probably passed it on to a lot of people. Maybe they're going for interviews or have a college presentation coming up. Or when you say, look, if you weren't nervous, you're nervous because you care. And he's kind of expanded on that, I suppose. And I love that sentence. The opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference. And you think about, oh, how are you getting on? Oh, I'm just not feeling it. Like, that's it there. There's just indifference. You're not buzzing in work. There's indifference. You're not buzzing playing your game of football, your Gaelic, your swimming, your sport, whatever you do. Ah, I'm not feeling it. There's indifference there. And that probably, even that sentence gives a better understanding as to why you may be feeling shit about your work. There's just indifference. You need something that compels you. You need love. You need fulfillment. And it's a lovely section of the book. That's close to the end of book one. Really like that. And I'm going to leave that for you to make up your own mind. Google that. Google his book, Stephen Pressfield, The War of Art. You're going to get clips of this on YouTube. You'll get snippets of it on if you Google it. I'd love people to check this out. And just to, I don't even want to read the book and get back to me. Give me your review. Just read a couple of the quotes. Read a couple of the sections, because I'm sure they'll pop up as graphics, as sort of relative to motivational quotes that you might find on the internet. Have a read of some of his stuff, and I'll challenge you. Have a look at your own procrastination. What do you put in the way of getting done what you should get done? No matter what it is. Because we all have it. We all procrastinate. We all hold off. And so I have 1,000 things I want to do. This podcast, my aim, I would love to get this out every Thursday, with the same structure every week, really organised. And I just, it's not going to happen. I'll just go ad hoc on it. But that's something I want to look at, putting a bit more structure on this. That's my challenge to you. Have a look at your procrastination. Pick one little action step to maybe bring yourself forward on it, and send your messages in. Get back. People are getting back to us. It opens up the conversation. It keeps it relative. I'm Spraying My Mental Health Podcast, episode 7, nearly coming to the end. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, iTunes, Spotify, whatever medium is relative to the handheld that you have. And do send feedback if there's particular segments that you've listened to and you've enjoyed. Send in your feedback, send in your opinion. If there's segments you don't enjoy, you don't like them, just let me know why, because I'm looking to improve it all the time. I cannot finish off without mentioning the beautiful tragedy that unfolded on Monday night. As some of you may be aware, I'm involved at a semi-professional level in football in this country, and that is a term I hate, semi-professional. It sounds like you're not all in. It's unjust and unfavourable to the lads. They train as professionals. The demands that are placed on them are the demands you'd place on professional footballers. They have to train, gym work, field work, matches, recovery work. they're doing that and they're not doing it for a wage in which you'd retire on. And on top of that, you've college, you've full-time work, you've kids, girlfriends, boyfriends. It's a big demand. And I don't think it's always appreciated what the effort that they have to put in. So anywho, on Monday night, we were 1-0 up from the first leg of a playoff game against Drogheda. With Shells, we never go about things the easy way. We two men sent off. Half an hour gone, 9 men. And there's no effort without error or shortcoming. And it was quite extraordinary. It really was. I mean, for the club, it's just, we had become this forlorn shell of lost ambition, and it's been such a fallow period in the club's history over the last 10 years or so. But on Monday, it was just one of the most extraordinary matches in the club's history. It was a beautiful tragedy, an incredible performance with a numerical disadvantage. I looked at it at half time in the dressing room. I'm looking around and I said, just calmness here. I said, these lads seem in control. And look, if you had to pick 9 lads to go to war with, I wouldn't have been straying too far from the 9 that were left on the pitch. Experienced senior pros, and nobody feeling sorry for themselves. They were ready for it. And there were moments throughout the game, like, they just looked invincible. Every tackle, every header, all these desperate moments, you had one cleared off the line. There was process and there was control. And for me, there was just that feeling it was written that something truly special was about to happen. Even when we broke away and scored, like, I was shaking with the excitement. It was incredible. You were so immersed in it. You were just present. There was nobody checking their phones, or you were paying attention to what was going on. And it was magic. Well, as I said, sometimes magic comes to nothing. And it was... Like, obviously, I'm quite subjective about it, because I'm so emotionally involved. And I mean, even afterwards, like, normally for me on the pitch afterwards, it'd be formal handshakes, you're distributing water and Lucozade, helping the guys with their recovery process straight away. But for me, like, it dropped everything. I've been hugging lads and kissing them on the forehead. Like, I was only short of building a statue of these 9 lads after the game. It was incredible. You're seeing grown men with tears in their eyes in the dressing room afterwards. It was so close to being something perfect. It was so close. It was almost too beautiful to win. So we were beaten on penalties. 10 months, a workload of 10 months that just comes to an end, gone in an instant. And that is that's the harshness of sport as we see it. To be objective about the night, I mean, look, it was a first round game of a 3-round series in the second tier of Irish football. Will it be remembered? I think as a player, I think players will remember it. Games come and go very, very quickly throughout a season. But under the circumstances of what unfolded, I think it's going to be one of them conversations in a few years. Do you remember that time we nearly did it? So I don't want to put it under that category of a moral victory. It wasn't. It wasn't in any ways. It was a special performance that was almost beautiful. If you were there, you'll understand. If you weren't, I cannot replicate the emotion that was there. I cannot replicate it, but it was truly, truly special. Wanted to leave this to the last part of the podcast. I love my heroes, Flawed. I'm slightly in love with all the lads after the other night, just the effort they put in. It just gave people hope and expectation, and I hope they deserve their break now, and they'll come back in January, hopefully staying at the club, build on what we've done. It's been a progressive season. We'd silverware, won the Leinster Senior Cup again. 3 defeats all season in the league. The margin for error in that division is usually quite high. So it's been a solid performance. We fell short in promotion, but it's been a solid season. It's been progressive. Enjoy the break now and we'll go again. Feckin' football. It's the hope that kills you. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.